Is the U.S. war on ISIS legal? This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. An army captain is suing President Obama over the war against ISIS. He claims the president doesn't have the proper authorization from Congress. The constitutional expert in the case says the captain is walking a fine line.
He believes in the war. He thinks the war is a just war. It's just he thinks that the war is not legal.
Also, how a Canadian citizen was radicalized in Pakistan after a chance encounter with the Taliban.
You know, I was just enamored by them. They were, you know, heavily armed and they were just sitting there. And I thought, what the heck? Who are these people?
And a Galician bagpiper on what it was like to be a part of Yo-Yo Ma's Silk Road project. Those stories and more coming up today here on The World. Thanks for joining us. We start today with a couple of stories linked to the fight against ISIS. The first one is about a 28-year-old Army captain named Nathan Michael Smith. He recently filed a lawsuit against President Obama for illegally waging war against ISIS. Now, it's not unusual for Americans to criticize the wars their country is fighting, but it is rare if you're an Army officer speaking out against the legality of the war in which you're actively serving. Bruce Ackerman is a constitutional consultant with the team that's filed the suit. Ackerman is a professor of law and political science at Yale Law School. He argues that Obama needs specific authorization under the War Powers Resolution. That was passed in 1973 after the Vietnam War and its unauthorized side conflicts in Cambodia and Laos.
Senators said, we cannot allow this to happen again. So Congress passed, over the president's veto, the War Powers Resolution, which set up basic ground rules. It said the president can intervene with military forces for 60 days. But during that period of time, he has to gain the explicit authorization of Congress to continue the war. And if he fails, he must withdraw the troops. This is the fundamental constitutional framework that is governing the United States at the present time.
What is wrong, though, with the post 9/11 authorization for war? Because ISIS is an offshoot of al-Qaeda, and that congressional authorization for war was focused on al-Qaeda.
Well, that's precisely the question. Does the authorization passed immediately after September 11th for a war against al-Qaeda in Afghanistan cover a completely different war against the Islamic State, which has repudiated al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda has repudiated it? That is the fundamental question which the court is going to answer.
Congress has repeatedly passed appropriations bills, though, to pay for operations against ISIS, and the administration supporters argue that counts as congressional approval, doesn't it?
Yes, that's what they argue. This would require an elaborate legal argument. I'm not at all convinced that this is the case, and we'll have to have a judge consider these arguments. The important point is that since the very beginning of the Republic, in 1802 to be precise, 1 year after the Supreme Court established judicial review as a fundamental principle of the American state, 1 year later, John Marshall, for unanimous court, established a second fundamental principle. It held that it was an obligation of the officers of the United States to consider whether the orders of their commanders-in-chief, the president, were actually constitutional and authorized by the statutes. Military officers cannot simply say, I'm following orders. They have an obligation to ask whether the president's orders are consistent with the law.
So is that kind of the justification for how Captain Smith can take this kind of action, basically suing the White House and the commander-in-chief?
Precisely, because, you see, he believes in the war. He thinks the war is a just war. It's just he thinks, and many other serious constitutional lawyers agree, both on the left and on the right. This is not a partisan kind of thing, that the war is not legal.
If there was an authorization for war against ISIS that you were satisfied with, do you think the war in Syria would be any less messy right now? Would Syrians be suffering any less than they are now?
I am defending the Constitution of the United States. If President Obama's precedent is allowed to stand, it will provide an authority for the next president and the president after that to declare a war on the basis of a 20 or 30 year resolution anywhere in the world on the ground that there is some connection with the original Al-Qaeda. This would be a very serious and, in my understanding, deeply unconstitutional transformation in American government.
Bruce Ackerman, professor at Yale Law School, thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Legal or not, the war against ISIS carries on in Syria and elsewhere, and the fighting has radicalized people from many different walks of life. Now, Canadian Mubin Sheikh found his way to extremism in an earlier decade, but his journey is a lot like that of many young Muslim men in the West today. Sheikh says his upbringing in Toronto was pretty typical. Then at age 18, he had an identity crisis. So he traveled to Pakistan in 1995 on a mission to find himself.
It's the identity crisis that a lot of Muslim youth are facing. You know, the idea of belonging in society. How much of, you know, Islam do you manifest before it becomes, you know, not good enough for the society? So you're almost forced to choose. And so, you know, I wasn't bullied or picked on in high school. We were the cool kids, but I was shamed and guilt tripped, you know, into feeling that, oh, I was such a bad person. So I tried to make right by going, you know, on a rebound almost. And you find this a lot with people who convert in prisons, you know, they're given this new, it's almost like a born again experience. And so in that born again experience, I went to Pakistan in 1995, met the Taliban, and until 2001, participated in, you know, this us versus them mentality.
You kind of mention meeting the Taliban as if it's an afterthought. Tell me about that. I mean, what did that show you?
Here I was from Canada. You know, I went to find myself. I go with a group who are staying in the mosques, and typical Canadian thing to do. I was just walking around trying to talk to the locals, see what's up. And I chanced upon these guys who are like sitting there armed to the teeth. Turbans, beards. And here I was like, yeah, I'm here to find myself and this and that. And they're saying, well, here we are. We're fighting this jihad. You know, jihad is the only way for Muslims to regain their, you know, their worth and value in the world. And I was like, okay, I became enamored. I thought here they were, these religious heroes from, you know, a romanticized Islamic age gone by.
How did that actually impact you when you were having that conversation with them?
I was with a local interpreter guy. I mean, I wasn't by myself, but even he was trying to kind of say, look, I could get from him, let's get out of here. But, you know, I was just enamored by them. They were, you know, heavily armed and they were just sitting there. And I thought, what the heck? Who are these people? You know, I didn't grow up with politics in my family life. So I didn't know who the Taliban were. Right?
But after that trip to Pakistan, you returned to Canada and politics are definitely in your life and you become more of an extremist. Yeah.
That's right. I started to become more aware of the geopolitical conflicts that rage, you know, in the world, the political grievances on which the vast majority of the, you know, so-called Islamist narrative is based. In 98, I got married. I married a convert, a girl that I knew from high school, Polish, and she converted, and we got married, and, you know, 18 years, 5 kids, you know, it's great still.
But at the same time, you were going through that process of recruiting other people.
Yeah, I didn't tell her, you know, who was hanging around with, right? So I had this double life almost that I felt like I was living.
Would she have left you if she'd known?
Oh, she would have been out of the door fast, of course. So I went on a honeymoon to, you know, Saudi Arabia. I did the, you know, religious rituals in Mecca and Medina with my new wife. That kind of, you know, it softened me up a bit, if you will. And then when 9/11 happened, you know, that told me, wait a second, you know, I don't know my religion properly. I didn't know any Arabic. I hadn't studied Islam properly under scholars. And so I decided to do that. And, you know, I was going to go to Syria because Syria, you know, ancient.
And what year was that you went to Syria?
This is 2002, early 2002.
Right. So this is long before, a good decade before the war there and the uprising.
That's right.
Ironically, it was in Syria that you became de-radicalized, though. Explain what happened.
Right. So I went there thinking that, you know, this great war was going to happen. And of course, maybe I was 10 years too early. And I thank God that I didn't stay. You know, I was legit. I registered with my embassy. I wanted them to know exactly where I was, my wife and two kids. I was there to study. And I found a sheikh, you know, a Sufi sheikh who went through the verses of the Quran that I used to appeal to. And say, look, you know, chapter 9, verse 5, you know, it says, kill them where you find them. And so he would say, well, do you normally begin reading from verse 5? You know, read verse 1 and read the verse right before it. This does not apply to those who did not break the treaty and who are not fighting you. So rather than it being some open license to kill just anyone who's not like you, it was in a very specific, you know, context. And so that Islamic teaching, proper Islamic teaching, is what got me out of it, that verse-by-verse debunking of the extremist narrative.
I mean, that sounds kind of academic. I understand this imam was a scholar, but what was it in that moment where you met him? What was his in his worldview that turned your thinking around? Because that's a big shift. That's 180.
So the credibility of the messenger himself, right? So this is a guy who... He smiled, you know, he smelled nice. He didn't need to berate me or insult me or like, because I was a complete fool. I didn't know any Arabic. You know, I had been reading from translations. I had been listening what people were telling me the Quran was saying. And here was a guy and he was very merciful and gentle in his approach. And that's really what I think, because these extremists, you see, they have a lot of pain in their life. It's angry, frustrated. You know, and they put all their energies into these violent means. But here was a guy who was saying, no, we are, you know, spiritual people. Like, there is a spirituality of Islam that you haven't even experienced.
If he had smiled or smelled nice and said, yeah, you're right, ISIS is the path to follow, would you have believed him?
Well, both of them look the same. Big beards. They might be wearing, you know, robes and turbans or whatever. But what these people cannot do, ISIS and their company, is show verse by verse how they're right. They appeal to a general narrative that they expect everyone will believe in. We're the caliphate, you know, and Islam was spread by the sword. Yes, this is what they affirm, right? Whereas, you know, the vast majority of Muslims who are fighting them are saying, no, you know, you have nothing to do with Islamic practice. This is why I call them terrorists in Islamic costume. So I think I had the intellectual luxury of growing up in the West to be able to be receptive to these different things and then to eventually pick a side, in which, of course, I signed up with the government. I sided with Canada, yes.
Mubin Sheikh is the author of Undercover Jihadi. Great to meet you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Probably not the kind of music you think of when I say the name Yo-Yo Ma, but for nearly two decades, the cellist has been jamming with top musicians from around the world. He calls it the Silk Road Project.
I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in the world because I'm surrounded by unbelievably great human beings who also happen to be unbelievably talented.
How Yo-Yo Ma ended up on the Silk Road, more of my conversation with him, coming up later here on The World. You're listening to The World. Medellin, Colombia has a reputation. It's a city where the infamous Pablo Escobar once commanded an international drug operation that dealt with its enemies in deadly fashion. But this next story isn't about cocaine cartels, although they are kind of a part of it. This is the tale of a community of Orthodox Jews living outside Medellin. It's been quite a spiritual journey for them. They were once Catholics, then became evangelical Protestants. Now they've embraced a deeply conservative version of Judaism, and they are thriving. Graciela Mochkovsky has written a fascinating article about this community in the California Sunday magazine. I asked her what drew her to this story in the first place.
So I actually been following this story for a few years. I started actually in 2003 writing about the first leader of community going from Catholicism to Protestantism to Orthodox Judaism in Peru. I'm working on a book on that community, and so researching on that group, which I thought originally was a completely isolated event in Latin America, I realized around 2009 that now throughout the continent we are getting an explosion of conversion to Judaism from previously Catholic or Christian communities. So the most organized of these new communities is this one in Medellin. So I decided to go there, stay with them for a while. I followed them to Israel, and, you know, I've been following the story, their story specifically, since 2009.
So people across Latin America like to say that thanks to the Spanish Inquisition and the flight of Jews all over Europe and across the ocean to the New World, everyone in Latin America can trace back at least 1/16 Jewish heritage. But these Jews in Bale have a different story. Drugs and drug violence led them to kind of the promised land, you could say, specifically the Negev Desert. Talk about that. That was kind of the starting point, right?
Yes. So the story starts in Medellin, in a suburb, in a poor suburb, very violent, as you said before, during the Pablo Escobar years. And the protagonists of the story are two men, they were teenagers then, who found a way out of the violence and of the street thanks to an evangelical church. So they first became members and leaders of this local Pentecostal church that they brought up, and they made it into a mega church of 3,000 people in the outskirts of Medellin. And once they were there, they started getting these connections with Israel. One of them, René Cano, who was the leader of the music band of this mega church, he was part of a group of young leaders of the community who were brought to the Negev Desert and to tour Israel for a month, together with a group of hitmen who were basically murdering people for Pablo Escobar and his cartel. So they were part of this rehabilitation program. The idea was that these church leaders and community leaders would mix together with the, you know, bad guys, these killers, and they would bring them to Israel and they would save their souls and their lives, and they would go back to Medellin and, you know, they would change these criminal young people's lives. So that's how René, who's now called Shlomo after he converted, got to Israel in the late 1990s. The other protagonist of the story, Juan Carlos Villegas, was the pastor of this church, eventually became the pastor, and he was invited around the same time to Israel as part of a group of Pentecostal, there's all this group of Christian Pentecostals who are close to Israel. They claim a strong connection with the Old Testament. And some of those groups are also, they call themselves the Messianic Jews. They think they are Jews and Christian at the same time. And he was part of a group visiting Israel in 1999, who found there a Pentecostal group, and there he found the Messianic Jews and was completely transformed by that experience. Mm. So that's how these two guys from Medellin, who were part of the same evangelical church, in two different moments get to Israel around the same time, and they come back to Colombia transformed, and that's where their conversion process towards Judaism starts.
And back in Medellin, I mean, the optics of this new conversion to Judaism, did it combine kind of the megachurch visuals with the new discovery of Judaism?
Yes, what they did is they shifted the megachurch towards Messianic Judaism. So they became a Messianic Jewish church, which is basically a Christian church who claiming a connection with Judaism. After a couple of years, they realized, especially the rabbi of this Christian Jewish church, he realized that Jesus, he went back to Israel. He started looking for answers, and he came to the conclusion that Jesus hadn't been the Messiah, and that he had been a rabbi and he was an important figure, but he was not the Messiah. So they had to abandon Christianity altogether.
Wow.
So he went back to Medellin. He gathered his 3,000, followers, the people from the church, and he announced to them in a very dramatic moment that they had to abandon Christianity. They had to be Jewish because that was the true religion, and that he understood if people didn't follow him. And it took him months of persuading them and, talking them, rereading the Bible with them, finding the clues of this newfound truth. Most of them abandoned him. The church was basically, shut down, and 600 people stayed with him and followed him into this new conversion.
Wow, a lot of spiritual discovery and a search for answers. How many converts are there just in Bayo and Medellin today?
So from those original 600, it's a very hard thing what they did. You know, they had to completely change their habits. Most of them, you know, severe ties with their families. They changed the way they eat, the way they pray. They stopped working on Saturdays. They changed the way they, you know, their clothes. All of the men got circumcised. They started learning Hebrew.
Circumcised in midlife. I mean, and all of
yes,
them did?
They did. In groups of 30, they went to this surgeon, and they got it done in a few days.
Wow.
But it was hard for most of the followers. So after a few years, about 200, 250 stayed, and that's basically the size of the synagogue now. The leader of this group, whose name is now Elad Villegas, he went to Israel. He became a rabbi. He got an ordination there from a yeshiva, and he came back as the rabbi of the community. They are now actually a respected community in Latin America. They have their own synagogue. They have their Hebrew center. They have their kosher chicken plant.
Wow.
They sell kosher food. They are a center of religious Jewish life in Colombia.
Yeah, so they'll cook a pollo asado, but it's a kosher pollo asado.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yes.
Very
exactly.
Cool.
Exactly, yeah.
So do you think this religious minority can thrive in the long term?
I think they are becoming the center of Jewish life in many countries in Latin America. You asked earlier about the figures. I didn't reply to that, but you have now a few tenths of thousands of these converts throughout Latin America. So it's not the millions that are becoming evangelical, but if you compare their numbers to the numbers of the traditional Jews in their own countries, you will see that in some cities, mostly in Colombia, but also in Peru, in Ecuador, in Guatemala, in El Salvador, and in other countries, you will see that they are about to outnumber the local Jews, the traditional Jews there, and they're growing. You know, 15 years ago, there was just one group or two groups, and now we have, I'm mapping them up, now we have around 60 groups in 14 countries.
Graciela Mochkowski, who's been writing about Colombians converting to Judaism, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up later on the show, merry pranksters in Cairo get busted for satire. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. New legislation in Kyrgyzstan has the LGBT community living in fear.
This man, Victor, that I met and many others said they suddenly found that they were being singled out and victimized in a way that they never had been before as a result of what's known there as the anti-gay propaganda law.
That story coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Let's go to a place now we don't often visit on the show, Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia. LGBT people are feeling the impact of some legislation there, and it isn't even law yet. The bill is patterned after Russia's so-called anti-gay propaganda law. And like LGBT people living in Russia, gays in Kyrgyzstan are being singled out, discriminated against, even assaulted. Reporter Andrew North got to know a group of LGBT people in the Kyrgyz capital, Bishkek. And a fair warning here, some of the details in the story are pretty disturbing. Andy, you write about one attack that would have been called a hate crime here in the U.S. Tell us about this man you met. You call him Victor for his own safety.
That's right, Marco. And, you know, a truly terrible story. He's a young man of 24, and he had been receiving a series of threatening messages on his phone and calls. As a result of those threats, he moved and hoped that was the end of it. Then one night he was coming home from work when he was attacked from behind. He said he had his headphones on at the time. He had no idea that there was anyone around, and he was beaten unconscious by his attackers. And when he came round, he found that they had driven him to a wooded area, a park on the edge of the city, he later realized. And he was then further beaten up, his clothes torn off, and then he was gang raped by the three men that had attacked him. And the whole time, he says, they were shouting abuse at him, saying that they had warned him they would come and find him. And they made it clear to him that they were attacking him because he was a gay man.
And Victor does not go to the police. He already had a terrible experience with police actually practically assaulting him. Kyrgyzstan had this reputation for tolerance. What happened?
That's right. I mean, certainly compared to the rest of Central Asia, it was seen as a relative beacon of tolerance. That's not to say that it was an easy place to be a member of the LGBT community. They knew certainly to kind of keep their heads down, but there were several gay clubs in Bishkek. And then once this legislation came in, or rather the talk of the legislation, because that's the key point, it still hasn't been passed. Mm. Once this was then discussed, they found they had become a target. This man, Victor, that I met, and many others, said they suddenly found that they were being singled out and victimized in a way that they never had been before, as a result of what's known there as the anti-gay propaganda law.
So the anti-gay propaganda law hasn't actually passed in Kyrgyzstan, as you say. But Victor told you something that I thought was really interesting. He says it's anti-gay. The word propaganda is in there, and most people interpret it as a license to attack homosexuals, even though it hasn't passed. Is that what you found in Kyrgyzstan?
Absolutely. I mean, I talked to a very large number of members of the LGBT community. I talked to activists, NGO groups around the city, who have all now gone underground because of the attacks against them. And in effect, what they said happened was that the anti-gay propaganda legislation, the proposed legislation, created a fake issue. It created, in the words of Victor, created this idea where he talks about permission to exterminate, with the words that he used, and so legitimized attacks on the gay community.
I mean, for the people who would support this law, it sounds like they don't even need it to pass. Does this law essentially amount to state-sponsored homophobia, whether it passes or not?
In the effect that it has had, it amounts to state-sponsored homophobia. Just like it has in Russia, where the inspiration for this legislation came from, it's become a useful way of creating division, and it is the gay community, the LGBT community, that are the victims.
So, Andy, you're also a pretty talented artist on top of being a journalist, and you made a series of illustrations that show us Victor's first-person account of the attack he survived. You also made a video out of those drawings. Tell us about what you did.
Obviously, this is a really, really hard story to tell. And first of all, it's hard to get people to actually talk about what has happened to them, given the violence that's been meted out. And then you can't identify them. I think no one I spoke to was prepared to have even their first real name used. I had to come up with different names for them. So what I would do is, during or after each interview that I did, I would then do a sketch, a drawing of the person I talked to. I would then show it to them. I would say, look, this could be published, so that they knew what could happen. As a result, I think it somehow brings home much more strongly the story than perhaps if we had videoed them, which would be the more traditional approach, but obviously kind of covering up their faces.
Well, I got to say, it is really powerful and very effective. Andrew North reports and sketches in the Caucasus region of Eastern Europe. You can see his video and drawings at PRI.org. Andy, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks very much, Marco. Good to talk to you.
Here's the sound of street children in Cairo. Okay, those aren't actually homeless street kids. It's a group of young Egyptian satirists who call themselves street children, or Olad El Sharawiya in Arabic. In this video, they're poking fun at Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. And street children have been arrested for making that video. They're facing charges of insulting state institutions and inciting protests. Carl Sharo has been following this. We've had him on the show before. He's a Lebanese satirist living in London and writes under the pen name Carl Remarks. I asked Carl to tell me more about that video.
They're talking about the way Sisi has been administrating Egypt and incapable of kind of taking control of the situation and kind of almost, you know, weakening the authority of Egypt externally and in terms of the Arab world, but associated with this very typical Egyptian sense of humor of mocking him personally, which is why I think is very important and very effective, because those kinds of figures in the Arab world try to place themselves above criticism and they try to represent themselves as benevolent fathers of, and usually they're fathers, it's never a woman, that they are these benevolent fathers of the nations and they're above critique, and usually they try to deflect criticism by saying there's some kind of incompetence in their administration, but they actually, the Aulad al-Shawari, they attack that directly and they say it's actually coming from him personally, it's not because of the people around him, and that's why it's so scathing.
The thing is, a lot of the Aulad al-Shawari videos get hits in the millions. Are the Egyptians who watch them just curious? Or do those hits show that street children are really popular with Egyptians and they agree with what they're saying?
No, I think they're absolutely, they're in sync with the public mood and the public sentiment in Egypt. But, you know, nothing is black and white. There might be people that started out supporting Sisi, but they're seeing this kind of complete erosion of liberties and any media platforms. I mean, we're not only talking about satire. We're talking about all media platforms completely abdicating their responsibility and towing the political line. So people are turning to the only alternative, which is social media. So it's important to emphasize that it's raw and it's quite organic. And I think that's a great measure of success.
What do you think it says about Egypt at the moment that the government is going after kids who are essentially just having fun?
Well, I think it shows how weak, really, the authority of the state is, because we've seen a very fast transition in Egypt over the past 5 years. When before that, you could argue that Mubarak's regime was a little bit softer touch, used a softer touch in dealing with dissent. And now we're seeing it completely. It's almost like, you know, in computer games where you go up one level and becomes harder. So it's almost like you get an even more oppressive state. But it's one whose authority is eroding very quickly.
Carl, you're a political satirist yourself. What is it like for a satirist to work in a country like Egypt these days? I mean, help us understand what kind of fire these young satirists are playing with.
These are real threats. People are not treating it as only jokes. They are, authorities in particular are threatened by that and they fear this message. And particularly, I think, because the message is raw and it speaks directly to people widely. It's kind of you know, there's a lot of courage to face up to this threat, and we're talking about context in which there's collusion between the state and not only we're talking about you know, imprisoning people. There's reports of torture, reports of extrajudicial activities of all sorts, and the mere fact that the Egyptian state is so threatened by it highlights the kind of the precarious condition that those young people are operating in and the risks that they're taking in order to carry this burden and responsibility of mocking and the authorities and kind of scrutinizing them in a way that the mainstream media is failing.
Carl Sharrow, a.k.a. Carl Remarks, is a satirist with a focus on the Middle East. He joined us from London. Carl, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Last night at sundown marked the start of Memorial Day in Israel. It's a day to remember fallen soldiers, but also civilians who died in bus bombings and other attacks. There's also another unique tradition, public sing-alongs. Here's Daniel Estrin from Jerusalem.
It's nighttime. The restaurants and bars are closed, and the square in front of City Hall is filled with hundreds of people on plastic chairs or cross-legged on the ground, wrapped in blankets. I sit in the way back. The woman next to me introduces herself as Esther. She grew up in New York.
It's really difficult for Americans, even my own friends, to understand why I'm here and why I stay here, because life is really, really difficult here. I have a stepchild who died. He died in a bus blast.
This was about 6 years ago.
He was with a friend, and the friend bent down to tie his shoes, and he sat. And so his friend survived, and he didn't. He was on his way to Oxford Medical School. He was a brilliant boy. He had signed a card to donate his organs. And in Israel, you cannot choose who the organs go to. So this child's organs went to a Palestinian girl.
She didn't want to talk about it. She was here to sing, alone, with a square full of strangers.
That's what Israelis do. We share our grief.
She hummed along to the friendship song. It's an oldie, written in 1948 to remember the young Israeli fighters who died in the war that led to Israel's establishment. It's a song of sacrifice for the greater good, written in a collective language. Long before karaoke made it to Israel, there were public sing-alongs, going all the way back to the early 20th century with the first waves of Jewish immigrants. They'd work in the fields in the day and gather at night to sing and to learn new Hebrew songs. In recent years, public sing-alongs have become popular with younger generations, especially on Memorial Day. Musicians and singers lead the crowd with the lyrics projected on a screen. They sing oldies and newer songs, like this 90s ballad, Fathers and Sons. It's also a song about loss and war and violence, but the words reflect a completely different sentiment. Not at all the collective song of heroic sacrifice. It's a song of personal anguish. Here are some of the words. Go away from here. Leave me alone to scream. It's almost the anti-sing-along song, but it too has a place at this sing-along. An Israeli friend shows up, Erela Ganan. I sit with her on the ground. She comes to this public sing-along every year.
I want to feel my sadness. I want to feel my national sadness, I guess. Together with my cynicism about the current political situation and my cynicism that I don't see this ending, I don't see this passing by. I don't know.
Two of her brother's friends died as Israeli soldiers in Lebanon at the end of the 90s. She was 13 or 14 years old then, and she became a political activist, rallying for Israel to pull out of Lebanon.
And I strongly believed that that would bring the end of wars and everything would be fine after that and everyone would love each other after that. So I was an activist for the Labour Party and they won in the election in 99. And then nothing changed. We left Lebanon. War continues, hate continues, violence continues, and still, I don't know, what's the end?
Some people boycott Memorial Day sing-alongs. Some, critical of Israel's militarism, consider them rituals of sadness that glorify war. Some attend an alternative Memorial Day ceremony in Tel Aviv together with Palestinians, a ceremony that marks both sides' pain. No matter how Israelis mark Memorial Day, it's a jarring time, because tonight, Memorial Day ends and Independence Day begins. And in this very same square, another public sing-along takes place, except with happy songs. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Jerusalem.
You're listening to The World. Yo-Yo Ma is one of the most prolific recording artists I know. For the past decade or more, it feels like once a year I receive a new CD in his acclaimed Silk Road series. They're always compelling and they always transport me. But a new documentary has just come out, and for me, it's a revelation about the Silk Road Project, how it started, and why Yo-Yo Ma went there. The film is called The Music of Strangers, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble. You have to see it. Here's the opening scene. Thank you. total, unadulterated joy, energy, excitement. I'm joined by Yo-Yo Ma and one of the members of the Silk Road Ensemble, Galician bagpiper Cristina Pato. Yo-Yo Ma, we'll talk about the Silk Road Ensemble, where it came from, in a moment. But Cristina, let me ask you first, what's going on in that scene? Where were you?
We are in the middle of Istanbul, actually.
Yeah, that's
we were
what I thought.
Performing. We were doing like a pop-up show, and it was really exciting because there is something about playing live music and amplified in the middle of a place that you don't know of the world that brings people together and creates this sense of community.
Everybody from the ensemble is there. Kehan Kalor from Iran, Kinan Azne from Syria, Wuman from China, you, Cristina from Spain. I mean, it's the globe is represented. Yo-Yo Ma, when you see this, does it feel like the restlessness that pulled you into the Silk Road project has paid off?
Well, I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in the world because I'm surrounded by unbelievably great human beings who also happen to be unbelievably talented.
I mean, Yo-Yo has this way of sharing his enormous generosity and curiosity and his way of letting us try out new things we have never tried before.
Let's talk about the beginning of the Silk Road Project, because I've always wondered where it came from. And as we learn in the film, there are several factors that led to it. One of them was a sort of challenge from Leonard Bernstein, who gave a talk at Harvard, Yo-Yo, when you were there as an undergrad. And he said this.
What's the relevance of all this musicolinguistics? Can it lead us to an answer of Charles Ives' unanswered question, whither music? And even if it eventually can, does it matter? The world totters, governments crumble, and we are poring over music.
Charles Ives, the great composer. Yo-Yo Ma, explain what that appeal from Leonard Bernstein, what did it mean to you at the time?
Wow, it's great to hear that voice again. Mm. It's so influential, and it's so true that all these years later, we are looking for relevance, and many things are better in the world, but there's also a lot of conflict, and there's a lot of fear. And I think Leonard Bernstein's words were prescient. You know, he used to say, with terror, with violence, we just do what we do with even more passion. And I think we've taken those words to heart. And I believe that the music of Strangers and the companion album, you know, Sing Me Home, are two examples of what people can do in the face of a changing world, an unknowing world.
Cristina, you're from Galicia in Spain, and frankly, Europe is more prone to the idea of bringing disparate cultures together in kind of these experiments. For you, though, how revolutionary was the Silk Road Project?
Well, I was trained as a classical pianist, although I had another life as a bagpiper doing a mixture of pop and rock. So to me, the Silk Road Ensemble became some sort of new home in which I could discover the connections between trying to do something deeply as we were doing in classical music and trying to communicate with people in a completely different way as I do as a bagpiper. And the Silk Road Ensemble is constantly providing all of us this sense of freedom and this sense of creativity of trying things that you would not even dare to try if you didn't have that space.
There's this great bit where composer Osvaldo Golijov is talking about his recommendation to you, Yo-Yo Ma, about an artist you needed to bring on board, and it was Cristina. Let's hear that.
Guys, you have to work with Cristina. She is amazing. She brings something so sensual, so earthy. She needs to be here because she brings something that is essential to the universal soul.
Well, the thing is, we didn't know what hit us when she first appeared in the basement of a Shakespeare and Company. But I think one of the things that's curious about musicians is that we're wanderers and we pick up things, just like your name, Marco, needs a polo attached to it.
Exactly.
It's the unseen part of you, Marco.
Cristina, you've seen Yo-Yo Ma at work. How does Yo-Yo get all these people to work together and find these sounds?
And Yo-Yo is just one of us, and that's his way of sharing and his way of creating this space for trying things out. And these are instruments that are not meant to be playing with each other. I play an instrument that is 120 dBs. That means if you have a violin next to me, you could not hear the violin. So the challenges are usually bigger than the things that make it easier. So everything takes a lot of time, a lot of patience, a lot of cultivation and nurturing. And he provides that level for all of us. Beauty comes out in a very natural way.
Can I just say 120 decibels? That is the math of the bagpipe. I have no idea. Yo-Yo Ma, we learn as much about you and your life and the music of strangers as we do about the Silk Road Project. And you point out that for the past 35 years you've been married, 22 of them you've been on the road. After all this time, do you feel like you're any closer to a universal language of music?
I feel I know a lot more about people. And the music that comes out of us is the totality of our experience. So it's not the sounds themselves, but it's what underneath the sounds that actually is the expression. Whether it's strong or weak or vulnerable or twisted, it's all there.
Yo-Yo Ma and Galician bagpiper Cristina Pato both feature in the new documentary, The Music of Strangers, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble, as well as its companion album, Sing Me Home. Great to speak with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Marco.
Thank you, Marco. Polo!
Yo-Yo and Cristina were in a remote studio, but something tells me his toe was not in the water. You can see the trailer for The Music of Strangers and find out how to see the entire film at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. On Instagram and Twitter, at Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Put a $20 gold piece on my watch chain so my friends will know I die. Six gamblers to carry my coffin, and six choir girls to sing me songs. Stick a jazz band on my hearse wagon to raise hell as I go along.
PRI, Public Radio International.